Welcome, everyone. The chair calls the Education Finance Committee meeting to order for Tuesday, March 17th. Is the quorum present? We do have a present quorum. Representative Hill, have you had a chance to review the minutes for Thursday, March 12th, 2026?
Yes, Chair. Just looking them over. They look great. I move their adoption.
Representative Hill moves adoption of the minutes for Thursday, March 12th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries. Members, before we proceed to House File 3900, we have two presentations that will set the stage for discussion on the bill. We'll begin with the Office of School Lands, School Trust Lands, and Director Aaron Vandelindel. Is that right? Did I get that right? Am I even close?
It's close, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It's Aaron Vandelindel.
How would you like me? I keep thinking of Seinfeld and Vandelay Industries, so you got to give me the right pronunciation.
It's Vandelindel.
Vandelindel. Thank you. Director Vandelindel, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, which we've already been through, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron Vandelindel, School Trust Lands Director. Appreciate the opportunity to present a little bit on school trust lands today, a little bit of the history and some of the context. I hope this does set the stage for the discussion of the Bill 3900 later on today. And after this, State Board of Investment will talk a little bit more about the year and a half long task force that we served on together. So real quick, just a quick agenda of where I'm going to take you today. First, I'm going to talk about the school trust endowment, what the endowment is for public education in Minnesota. Go through a real quick 10-year revenue generation distributions, then give you the history, legal foundations, and then just talk a little bit about what my office does or the Office of School Trust Lands does and some of the things we're working on. So jumping right in, the school trust, the way I like to think about it, it has two main assets. The first asset would be 2.5 million acres of school trust lands. That's a united mineral and surface estate, and we have another 1 million acres of severed minerals.
So, and Mr. Vandelindel, one sec. Members, yes. The information is in your packets. I should have noted that. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 3.5 million acres of school trust lands that are managed by the Department of Natural Resources for their natural resource benefits and to support the mineral economy, the timber economy, and we also do some real estate sales. Like that. The other asset of the trust is the $2.3 billion that's actually in the fund itself. And that $2.3 billion has come historically from natural resource management, so timber management, minerals management, real estate sales, easements, and things of that nature. And the other part of it is a little bit of investment growth from when we sold land and sold it under contract for deeds. So we did earn some interest early in the 20th century. So you can see how we really manage the land right now, or DNR manages the land. You'll see in the minerals resources that accounts for about 90% of our annual revenue. Historically speaking, that's about 80% of what is in the fund right now. So just put it a little bit more in context. So the fund value is $2.3 billion. That's the financial investments. Of those financial investments, the cash basis, or what we've actually earned from natural resource management, the basis of that is about $1.1 or $1.2 billion. So of that $1.1 billion, 80% of that has historically come from iron mining rents and royalties, 9% from forest products, 7% from real estate. I mentioned the sales earlier, and then the 4% investment returns from those sales. That 4% investment return is entirely different than the investment returns that the SBI gets. This is the investments from the natural resource instruments. So contract for deed sales, interest on accounts that we have for mineral revenue and things of that. Distributions over the last decade have been over $300 million to school districts. Last year, we added it $58 million. That goes out to all school districts, public school districts in the state, and charter schools in the state. So that is, well, I'll point it out, because I think most people in this committee would know that that is money that goes directly to the school districts without a legislative appropriation. They don't have to come to the legislature to ask for this money. It goes to them in two equal payments, one in September, one in March. So they just received their March payment. So over the last year, as I mentioned, DNR manages the natural resources. Annually last year, they generated $28 million in gross revenue. That is, again, mainly from iron mining and timber sales. I'd point out that that is down by about 40 to 50%, and that's a direct result of, well, I'll just say it's the economy, right? It's easier to say that way. On the other side of the screen, you can see where the money was distributed. This is an interactive map that's available on the Office of School Trust website. You can click on any school district. Those are all school districts in the state. You can click on any of those school districts. It'll pull up how many students are in that district and what the distribution was for that district. So biggest school district in the state, Anoka-Hennepin, my school district, receives the most money. And I would point out that roughly 52% of all of the revenue that's distributed comes to the metro. Moving on, so where did these lands come from? How did we get them? Just real quick, this is something that I take great pride in. I say it every time I do this. I'm a native of the state of Virginia, not Virginia, Minnesota, the state of Virginia. I big Thomas Jefferson fan, and I believe that this is Thomas Jefferson's work in the General Land and Ordinance from 1785. He had a quote in there that said, knowledge being, I'll skip the quote. Jefferson had the idea, this is how we were going to fund education in the new territories coming in. And if you'll remember, the United States did not have any money at the time the new states were coming into the Union. So how are they going to support education? How are they going to support the new states? They did it through these federal land grants. Minnesota ended up with four different federal land grants. Our first grant was at statehood in 1858. That was the original school trust grant. That was section 16 and 36 of every township in the state. We ended up with about 2.5 million acres. We have sold off the majority of those original section 16 and 36 lands in southern Minnesota and western Minnesota, where the majority of our good farmland is. We own about 400 acres in total. There's still a law in the books that says we can't sell school trust lands for less than $5 an acre. I'd love to get that deal. If anybody has it, let me know. But we don't have that deal anymore. Most of our land is in 10 northern counties in northeast Minnesota. So 2.2 of our current 2.5 million acres are in 10 northern counties. The other three federal grants replaced lands through the Indemnity Act. So if land was, the original Section 16 or 36 was underwater, inside a reservation boundary, or already conveyed, the federal government replaced that with indemnity lands. So we ended up with a hundred thousand more acres there. And then the big one was the Swamp Act that was extended to Minnesota and Oregon in 1860. And the Swamp Act allowed Minnesota to select the lands that it wanted in the state, and Minnesota selected all of those lands. We ended up with about 5.5, 5.6 million acres of those lands, and we still have a lot of those lands. A lot of what's left from our, what we have left is a lot of school trust land is actually from the Swamp Act, but the way we handle it on our Constitution is all of those funds or any revenue that's generated on those lands go into this permanent school fund. So you can see this is described it earlier and then just a second ago. The orange squares or dots on the map are your million acres of severed mineral rights. That's where we sold the surface and retained the minerals. Everything that is in dark blue is a unified surface and mineral estate. I would note we do have some school trust lands inside reservation boundaries. We are working to address some of those. It's going to take some time. There's about 180,000 acres in there. And I would point out that most of those are swamp trust lands. So moving on to the Office of School Trust Land, and this is, I'm trying to be quick, Mr. Chair, so we can get on to the what I think is the main course, which is House File 3900. Our office, this office was created in 2012. It was a compromise. My job is in statute. It's 127A353. That is my job description. And I am more or less an advisor to the executive branch and the legislative branch on all things school trust lands. So I work with DNR quite frequently on day-to-day management activities, strategic planning, things of that nature, specific projects. I work with the legislature on legislation that actually would, legislation initiatives that would actually improve the asset allocation of the school trust. And then the big thing that we're working on, we have been working on for the better part of 8 years now, is our long-range strategic planning. The statute requires us to do a 25-year management framework. We have done the first phase of that in 2021. We had five recommendations coming out of that that we have to address. But you can see the goals. These goals are in statute of what needs to be in that strategic plan. So we are looking to, you know, balance the revenue enhancement and resource stewardship. We do have to retain our core assets. We do have to look for new revenue opportunities. And that's why we're looking to diversify through some of our ecosystem service projects and things of that nature. So that, the big recommendation that came out of phase one of that asset management report, though, was that the Department of Natural Resources does not understand its management costs. We have a good handle on revenue. They have no idea on management costs. So that has been the last year, if not more, of trying to determine what management costs are and the cost allocation so that we can determine how well the trust is operating from a land management standpoint. That will take at least another year, but hopefully it'll be right in time for the next budget cycle. So, and this is just a screenshot of our website. Again, if you wanted to check that interactive map, you'd go to this website, click on revenue distribution, and that interactive map is at a link at the bottom of that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Mr. Van Allen. Just a couple quick things, and then I'll turn it over to Chair Joaquin for questions. But by way of history, since you mentioned TJ, 2012, I believe that was spearheaded by former Representative Denise Dietrich and Representative Tim O'Driscoll. Is that my memory serving me correct, that bipartisan effort?
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. I commonly refer to Representative Dietrich as the godmother of school trust lands.
And I, just to accent that a bit, as I said in my comments, very bipartisan at the time. And because of that work, we're here today. So thank you for that. Mr. Strom, these funds, when they're dispersed twice a year, what account do they flow into?
Mr. Chair, members, the permanent school fund payments go out in the twice annual payments, and they're received by school districts as part of their general operating fund. So they're an undesignated source of revenue in the school district general fund.
Undesignated source of school revenue. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Chair Joaquin, comments?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Vander. Director Vandalindy. Is that correct? Vandalin.
It's Vandalind. It's actually, if you were Dutch, it's pronounced Vandalinda.
Oh, now you've made it easy.
Now I've made it real easy, right.
which I should know since one of my daughter-in-laws has a Dutch last name. So thank you. No, thank you for the presentation. And I just had the, I don't know if it's drawing the short straw or the privilege to be on the LCC School Trust Land, Legislative Land Commission and late to the table when it comes to all the work you all did to put the constitutional amendment together. But you did note, as you noted in your presentation, about 13% of the school trust land, about 110,000 acres, is on seven different tribal nations. What does your, how does your government-to-government interaction work when you make decisions with the tribal nations?
Director Vandalin?
Thank you, Chair. Chair Joachim, for the question. Members, I'm not trying to be flippant. I don't make decisions. I'm an advisor. I provide advice to the DNR. They make the ultimate decisions, and they have to go through current statutes with regard to consultation and things of that nature under 1065. We've worked that into our internal process of how we actually provide advice to DNR to ensure that DNR's done that consultation before they actually bring something to us. But my office doesn't make decisions with regard to land management.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Krusha, and thank you for explaining that, and thank you for working that into your process. And maybe, I don't know if this should wait for when 3900 comes up, but just wondering how the tribal nations were consulted when the change to the constitutional amendment was proposed and if all 11 tribes had been consulted. And I don't know if you want to answer that, if we just want to punt and wait until the bill's up. Mr. Chair, I'd leave that discretion up to you.
Director Vandalin, do you want to take a shot at that, or do you want to let that sprinkle throughout the testimony today?
I think I'll let that sprinkle throughout. I don't know how to answer that. This was a legislative initiative from last or 2 years ago. It did require appointments from the governor's office and the Permanent School Fund Commission. We did have one tribal member, Tracy Lotka from the White Earth Band, on the commission. She was appointed, or the work group appointed by the governor. I can't say that we consulted with them as required. I don't think we're required to under 1065 to consult with them, but we did have a tribal member on the task force.
Chair Yuki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll continue the discussion later with the bill.
Very good. Thank you very much. And with that, Director Vandalin, if you would stick around closely in case other further questions come up. With that, we're going to move on to the State Board of Investment for the Permanent School Fund Task Force. Mr. Blumenschein and then Mr. Christensen and then Mr. Mule. So we'll start with the Vice President of Fixed Income. If you'd state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nate Blumenschein. I am Vice President of Fixed Income for the State Board of Investment. Okay, and I'll just get started. It is my pleasure today to present an overview.
If I may, Chair?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. I'm Andy Christensen, Deputy Executive Director with the SBI, and I know many of you are quite familiar with what we do, but thought it might be beneficial to just spend a minute on who we are and what our purview is in total, if that sounds okay.
You have the floor, Mr. Christensen. Why don't you begin with that?
Thank you. Again, Andy Christensen, Deputy Executive Director at the SBI. And very briefly, the SBI is a 49-staff nonpartisan agency charged with managing $161+ billion in assets. Our primary mission is to provide investment returns to support the retirement security of over 850,000 Minnesota families and people. We are fiduciaries and stewards of the capital. Are about approximately two-thirds of that $161 billion, or $107 billion, is attributable to what we refer to as the combined funds, that is the pension funds for the Public Employees Retirement Association, Minnesota State Retirement System, and Teachers Retirement Association. And to be clear, we are charged, we are fiduciaries and stewards of that capital, but the benefits and policy management is done by separate entities, PARA, TRA, and MSRS, as mentioned. In addition to the combined funds, we manage approximately $25 billion in a number of different trusts and accounts, one of which is the Permanent School Fund. Other things in that total would include some other state trust funds, the Minnesota College Savings Plan, Healthcare Savings Plan, Environmental Trust Fund, et cetera. And then on top of that, we manage approximately $28 billion in state cash. And it's worth noting, aside from the state cash account, all of our management is done via external managers, where we do the due diligence and research and then end up investing with external managers. The state cash account, we trade internally, and there we buy and sell directly short-term safe credit opportunities such as overnight repo and short-term credit. And then lastly, I would just mention our governance is defined in Article 9 of the Constitution, and our board is comprised of the four constitutional members of the state, the governor, auditor, attorney general, and secretary of state. With that, with your permission, Chair, I would turn it over to Mr. Blumenschein.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. And with that, back to you, Mr. Blumenschein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it is my pleasure today to present an overview of the Permanent School Fund Task Force report and the extensive work that this task force has done over the last year and a half. I'm going to start with a quick review of the Permanent School Fund since Mr. Vandalin did such an excellent job going through that moments ago. I'll talk briefly about the establishment of the task force and then spend most of the presentation discussing the research and analysis that led to the recommendations of the task force that will be the conclusion of this presentation. And then I'm happy to answer any questions that come up during the course of the presentation. Please note that all of the information that I'm going to share in this presentation is available in more detail in the actual Permanent School Fund Task Force report. So, as Mr. Vandalin was describing, the origins of the Permanent School Fund date back to the early history of our country. In 1858, the Minnesota Constitution established the fund to create a permanent self-sustaining source of education using the methods that Mr. Vandalin described. Minnesota law, both the Constitution and in statute, specifies how the fund should be managed and the formula by which the amount available for distributions is calculated. Today, there are three state agencies that are involved in the ongoing operations of the fund. As previously discussed, the Department of Natural Resources is responsible for everything related to the land management aspect of the Permanent School Fund. So that is all the specific parcels of land that are in the school trust are managed to generate revenues that are then transferred to the Permanent School Fund at the State Board of Investment. The State Board of Investment is responsible for all the investment management aspects of the Permanent School Fund, investing those revenues in financial assets, stocks, and bonds, and then ensuring that the proper amounts are available for distribution. These distributions are then sent to the Department of Education, which is responsible for apportioning the funds to school districts to support education. The Permanent School Fund Task Force itself was established in May 2024. Members were required to have outstanding professional experience in at least one of the following areas: institutional asset management, investment finance, trust administration, investment fund accounting, investment banking, or the practice of law in the areas of capital markets, securities funds, trusts, foundations, or endowments. The task force was made up of nine different members. One of the members was the Commissioner of Education, or the Commissioner's designee, Daley Lehman, an employee or other member appointed by the State Board of Investment, Andrew Kreck, four members appointed by the governor, Denise Dietrich, Tracy Furick, Tracy Lotka, Aaron Vandeland, and three members appointed by the vote of the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission, Therese Spano Madden, Paul Peltier, and Julie Sandsteed. The statute established the task force clearly specified its duties. The duties of the task force were to examine the historical returns of the permanent school fund endowment and evaluate and recommend potential changes to the distribution of earnings. The task force may examine school trust endowment policies in other states. The task force recommendations may include proposed changes to state statutes and Minnesota's constitutional provisions governing the school trust fund endowment. The task force met many times over the course of a year and a half, and as charged, delivered the report to the legislature on January 15th of this year. Now, early in its work, the task force determined that any recommendation to modernize the permanent school fund should be guided by the following principles. First, to maintain the permanent school fund as a perpetual financial resource. This means that distributions from the fund must not unduly draw down the fund's balance or impair its ability to serve as a lasting source of educational funding in the future. Second, establish a distribution policy that balances the needs of current and future beneficiaries. This means that the fund should be allowed to grow in a way that preserves its purchasing power for future generations while also providing consistent support to current beneficiaries. Third principle was to ensure consistent annual distributions. This means to minimize significant year-to-year variability in distributions in order to better support the planning and stability needs of school districts. And finally, to allow for adaptability in investment management, providing the State Board of Investment with the flexibility to manage the fund according to best practices today, maximizing long-term value without taking undue risk. Consistent with its charge, the task force reviewed the current legal framework governing the fund and observed two major constraints on fund distributions. First, distributions are limited to net interest and dividend income, excluding capital gains from asset appreciation from distribution consideration. Furthermore, capital gains and, if necessary, interest and dividend income must first be used to offset losses, reducing or eliminating distributions in loss recovery years. The task force concluded that this current framework unduly restricts fund distributions. Capital gains, meaning the increase in asset value of a stock or bond, are a significant source of investment returns today, with no mechanism to capture this value and distribute to school districts. This creates an imbalance between the interests of current and future beneficiaries, because the fund grows without proportionate distribution growth to school districts today. In addition, the mechanical procedure for offsetting losses may result in inconsistent yearly distribution amounts. Finally, because this is all written in the Constitution, it is difficult to adapt to changing circumstances or current best practices because of the effort required in a constitutional amendment. Consistent with its charge, the task force examined the historical returns of the permanent school fund and observed strong performance over time. This bar chart shows the permanent school fund's returns in light blue and the returns of the fund's benchmark in dark blue. As you can see, over each of the reporting periods, the permanent school fund has exhibited strong relative returns, meaning outperforming the benchmark, as well as strong absolute returns. In fact, average annual investment returns over the past decade have been 8%. The fund itself is invested in a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, and cash, and managed by external managers that the SBI oversees. These strong investment returns, along with revenues from land management have doubled the fund's value over the last 10 years and more than tripled its value over the last 15. However, because the Constitution limits distributions to interest and dividends, distributions have averaged only 2.5% of the fund's value during that period. After examining the historical returns, the task force conducted significant research and analysis on alternatives distribution policies for the fund. The task force started by reviewing best practices for educational trust management from around the country, including other states and educational institution endowments. The task force relied heavily on Makita Investment Group, one of the SBI's general consultants with significant expertise in this space, for the analysis of a broad sample of educational endowments. One of the first observations of the task force was that almost all distribution methods based their policies on a percent of market value of the fund rather than interest and dividends or some other metric. In addition, consultant research indicated that most endowments distribute between 4 to 5% of their average value annually. This is because this range is considered sustainable. It balances current funding needs with long-term preservation of purchasing power. The chart on this slide shows the average distribution rate from a survey of educational endowments. You will observe that regardless of size, small endowments below $50 million to large endowments over $5 billion, all are within the same range of distribution rates over time. In addition, if we extended this chart back for several decades, back into the 1970s, it would show a relatively similar pattern of general band of distribution rates that institutions use. Moreover, the average period over which that institutions calculate this distribution rate is several years, with 3 years being the most common. After reviewing a range of options for calculating annual distributions to Minnesota school districts, the task force concluded that distributing 4.5% of the average market value of the fund over the previous 3 years aligns with common practices among educational trust funds and endowments and is consistent with the fund's objectives. The task force took these observations from other institutions and evaluated these best practices for their suitability specific to the facts and circumstances of the permanent school fund. Aon Investments, another SBI general consultant, provided the initial modeling for some of these scenarios. Then the task force worked with SBI staff to evaluate the impact of distribution policy choices in a variety of market environments. SBI staff used the historical returns, asset allocations, revenues, and forward-looking distribution assumptions to develop these fund-specific models. The scenarios modeled higher returns, lower returns, negative returns, highly volatile conditions, and more. There were periods of some scenarios using 20% declines in market value. Distribution rates between 3 and 5% were evaluated. Averaging periods of 1 to 5 years were reviewed, along with a variety of other variables to see the impact on the fund given these different assumptions. In all of the scenarios, it was quickly apparent that the distribution rate represents a trade-off between current payouts and long-term fund growth. The task force also observed that fund value declines only when the distribution rate exceeds the combined value of investment returns and land management revenues. A distribution rate of 4.5% can be expected to nearly double the near-term distributions while also achieving long-term growth of the fund. And using the 3-year rolling average provides a mechanism for smoothing distributions by reducing year-to-year volatility of distributions while remaining responsive to prolonged market downturns. The two different graphs on this slide are just an example of three of the scenarios that the task force looked at. Starting with the bar graph titled distributions, we can see that the distribution amount, again, nearly doubles using a 4.5% distribution rate from the current method. Now, the purple bar is the above CME or above capital markets expectation scenario, and the blue bar is the below CME or the below capital markets expectations bar. And you can see how the methodology would adjust the distributions if returns are either above or below expectations. But the three-year average provides a mechanism for smoothing these distributions so they're predictable and allow for planning in school districts if necessary. Moving to the permanent school fund market value line graph, we can see the importance of the smooth reductions in distributions in protecting the long-term value of the permanent school fund. In scenarios in which capital market expectations are not as high as expected, the mechanism for reducing the distribution as the market value of the fund does not grow helps prevent the fund's principal from declining to low levels. Of course, there's an upside also. If investment returns are higher than expected, the formula would increase distributions to school districts. Taken all together, the 4.5% distribution rate and the three-year rolling average period align with industry best practices and achieve an effective balance between providing stable distributions and preserving the purchasing power of the fund for future generations. I just went through all the points on this slide on the last slide, so I'll just skip ahead to the next one. Now we come to the specific recommendations from the Permanent School Fund Task Force. Based on its research and analysis, the task force recommends amending the Minnesota Constitution and statutes to manage the fund in accordance with the task force guiding principles. The task force recommends that the Constitution should state the enduring principles and objectives of the fund, while the specific operating details of distribution policy, governance, and investment management should be established in statute. Furthermore, the task force recommends adopting a 4.5% distribution rate, calculated using a three-year rolling average of fund value to replace the current interest and dividends-only formula. The task force observed through the course of its work that this best achieved balance between the needs of current and future students. In conclusion, as directed by statute, the task force examined the returns of the permanent school fund and its current legal framework and found that the fund has grown significantly due to a combination of investment returns and land management revenues. It also found that outdated constitutional and statutory restrictions have limited its ability to balance the needs of current and future beneficiaries. The task force research demonstrates that adopting a modern market value-based distribution model would better align the fund with best practices used by peer states and educational endowments. A 4.5% distribution rate based on a three-year rolling average can provide more stable and predictable funding for current beneficiaries while preserving the fund's long-term purchasing power for future generations. After over a year's worth of meetings, research, and analysis, and careful consideration, the nine members of the Permanent School Fund Task Force unanimously endorsed the recommendations contained in this report. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Mr. Christensen, for your presentation. Very thorough. With that, Mr. Mule, General Counsel.
He doesn't have anything to add right now, Chair.
Nothing to add? I don't know. Those of us that are insomniacs are waiting patiently. All right. With that, members, we'll see if there's – I have a couple people on the list for – so you guys can stay up. Representative Lee, questions for the testifiers?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think this question is probably best for Mr. Blumenschein. I'm wondering if you can tell us more about the land management revenues. I'm looking here, and I didn't see if we could see an analysis of like what that has been every year, or just where are these revenues coming from also.
Mr. Blumenschein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'll refer to the Permanent School Fund Task Force report and find the page where we discussed the historical revenues from land management. Beyond that, I'll have to pass the question off to Mr. Vandalin for additional context. But on page 10 of the Permanent School Fund Task Force report, you can see through the time period that we had access to when we produced the report that the revenues from land management ranged from, mid-teens in millions of dollars per year to years of over $50 million a year. So that was the general range. Obviously, there are a lot of variables that go into what revenues are year to year from land management. Yes, if there's more details, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to recognize Mr. Vandalin for additional context.
Representative Lee, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So, I asked that because I understand, you know, there are a variety of other educational institutions that draw about like 4 to 5% from their endowments every year. And I think that's kind of the industry standard that you're talking about using here. But but those endowments get, right, like hundreds of millions of dollars of donations every year. And so curious if when you were talking about this industry standard, like where that's coming from, right? If there are other states with a land trust like this, or, you know, what do you mean when you say like this is an industry standard?
Mr. Blumenschein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Very much appreciate the question. When we were reviewing the practices of other educational endowments, specifically those that receive donor contributions on an annual basis to their endowments, we were not able to observe a strong correlation between the expected fundraising prowess or the expected rates of donations and the spending models of those institutions. There was a surprisingly stable range of distribution rates, regardless of the revenues generated by those institutions. Again, very different, of course, because it is based on donations from alumni in many cases or other sources.
Representative Lee, one more follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, and my question just comes from the fiscal note. So I don't know. I thought it was more appropriate to ask it here, because if you look on page 10, the note from the investment board, it says under long-term fiscal considerations, the fund's long-term investment performance will impact the amount of distributions from the fund. In the event the fund's performance does not meet or exceed the withdrawal rate of 4.5%, the fund may experience loss of principal. And for me, I mean, I just raise that, right, because institutions like Yale or Harvard never dip into their principal, right, because they have enough to pull from interest. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what would happen to our trust fund here.
Mr. Blumenschein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you for the question. In conducting the scenario modeling, we observed a variety of different stress scenarios in which there were prolonged periods of market downturns, of poor investment performance. One of the benefits of having a distribution rate that is based on market value is that as the fund declines, now to be clear, this is would be a scenario that we would not expect. As the fund declines, the distribution amount also declines, right? So the distribution rate stays constant, the distribution amount declines proportionate to how the value of the fund changes over time. even in looking at some pretty extreme scenarios, such as two different years of equity returns of negative 20% in a row, and a prolonged period of recovery from that. Again, the fund value did not grow, but the fund did not deplete itself because the distributions adjust to those lower market values over time.
Thank you. Chair Youakim, did you want to go now or wait?
Chair, actually, this question's for
Chair Youakim.
Yes, thank you. I think you'd be able to answer this question as well, Mr. Blumstein. I know you had mentioned the 50-50% mix between securities and the S&P 500 and then bonds, and that there had been a larger growth in capital gains this year. We all saw that in the budget forecast. Reminder, capital gains is no are based on non-wage earners. It's gains in investments, and which seem to go gangbusters this year. But I'm wondering, we were also told during the forecast that that's a very unstable part of our forecasted revenue stream. When you were looking at modeling, did you kind of smooth the edges and look at the median versus the average on that, just to make sure that you weren't overshooting on what those that forecasted gains would be?
Mr. Blumenschein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Youakim, thank you for the question. We looked at a variety of return scenarios, and as an investment professional, the one thing that we know is that the returns are not going to be smooth. We can't predict what the future is going to look like. Our efforts involve building a portfolio that we believe will stand the test of time, and thus diversification is really important to the State Board of Investment in general and in all our practices, but especially for a fund like this, the Permanent School Fund. Certainly, there is uncertainty in equity markets. The current asset allocation of the Permanent School Fund, having 50% in fixed income, is designed to manage that volatility as much as possible. But certainly there is volatility in markets, and our goal is, as a long-term investor, to stay the course and present diversified or manage diversified portfolios for the long-term success of the funds that we manage.
Chair Youakim, follow on.
Thank you, Chair Kusha. I just want to thank you, Mr. Blumstein, for all the technical expertise that you provided to the task force. It was very valuable, and I appreciate you.
And thank you for that. And quick note, Mr. Blumstein, not to be flippant, because I actually read a lot of prospectus, and I love what you've done here. As we talk, and using words like volatility and correlation actually are pretty exciting to me. But what I one thing that I want to call out as we start to look at this in investments, the dollars, as you've identified, that are not dispersed. So if we were to hold those back and be even more conservative than the very conservative stress test you've put, those dollars, as I understand it, not getting invested in education have the most certainty, and that is just they're just not getting used. So not really looking for a comment, but as I'm listening through, that's the understanding I'm drawing from what you're putting together. So you can nod your head, or if you want to make a comment, you don't need to, but just that's how I'm putting that. Mr. Blumenschein?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I appreciate that observation. The distribution rate is a trade-off. It is a trade-off between dollars spent today on education and dollars invested for the future in education. The conclusion of the task force was that there currently is an imbalance between current beneficiaries and future beneficiaries, and the recommendation is designed to create more of a balance between current and future beneficiaries.
Okay, yeah, very good. Thank you for that. Yeah, and that you hit it right in the head. I mean, you're balancing the needs. I won't even say it any better than you did. I like the way you put that balance together. So thank you for that answer. Representative Bonner. And just 1 second. Members, I see you're jumping on the list. We do have a lot of time. We're going to get to the bill, so I'm happy to put you on the list. But if your question may pertain to other testimony and all that, just looking for efficiency. But Representative Bonner, you're up.
Yep. And these might be sort of tied together a little bit. So I'm just going to kind of go, and then I'll let you fill in the blanks here. So you said, and I'm sorry I missed it, you said our current plan is the dividends plus something. as opposed to a 4.5% future, which to try to give a little bit more stability. But I'm curious about that, and I'm curious about what percentage of the fund is actually distributed today as part of that dividends plus the whatever. And if that exceeds what we're currently getting in a 4.5. So in other words, what would be the gap, right? Like how much more money would we be putting in the hands of our schools as opposed to the average rate of, and what is our average rate of return per year that we're gaining on the land trust funds?
Mr. Blumenschein?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'll try to answer all those questions. If I don't get to all of them, please follow up. So first, the current formula is that the permanent school fund can distribute any interest earned on fixed income investments in the fund and any dividends earned on equity investments in the fund to the Department of Education. So that's the first one. That has amounted to a variable percentage over the past years because it's not based on the market value of the fund. Frankly, it's much more based on something like interest rates, which have recently had a tremendous shift in the last 5 years from very low to higher rates. And so that percentage has averaged in the range of 2.5% over the last 10 years. So I think to get to your final question, the difference would be about 2% more. Of course, there's some variability there. So from 2.5% to 4.5% is the proposed distribution formula.
Representative Bonner, follow up.
Thank you. That's actually what I needed to know. Thank you. That's helpful.
Very good. Let's go to Representative Quam. Do you have a quick question or do you want to hold off? Okay. Members, with that, so thank you for your testimony. That concludes your point, your part. You can please stick around. And now at this point, we can take the bills in any order, and I've moved House File 3900 to the end. Come on, that was pretty funny. Welcome to the test of the fire station, Representative Igo, and we'll get ready to take your bill. Members, as Representative Igo is settling in, I will move House File 3900 before the committee for re-referral to the Committee on Rules. Representative Igo, I believe you have a DE amendment, DE3, if that's correct. And I know we were trying to get this all right, so I'll allow the DE3 to come in as an author's amendment. Any discussion to that before we go to vote?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I thought you were going to, you was going to offer the DE4 that came in this morning. Oh, that is the D3? Oh, sorry.
This is the one.
I have my numbers mixed up from a bill this morning, so okay. Thank you.
So thank you. So just to make sure, this would get the bill, as I understand it, with the agreement, you've had several conversations in the bill that you and others would like to see it.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Very good. With that, members, we have the DE3 in front of us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Representative Igo, House File 3900 is in front of the committee in the shape that you would like. Please begin with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This might be the easiest way to talk about
it. My apologies.
Oh. Okay, you didn't hit the gavel.
Let me go back and do that.
Let's start over.
Members, the chair moves the DE3 amendment. All in favor, let's just do it all over. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the ayes have it. The DE3 amendment is adopted. Representative Igo, 3900 is in front of the committee in the shape that you would like. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Unique opportunity to have some really highly trained professionals talk about your bill before you get up here. So I'm feeling very spoiled today. But thank you for the opportunity. This bill, again, there's a lot of work that got us to this point. I want to thank a lot of the co-authors, Co-Chair Krisha, Co-Chair Joachim, members of this committee are on this bill. Thank you. It's a really exciting bill, and I want to walk through the DE so I explain what happened there. There really wasn't many changes that we did to the language that's different than the Senate. However, the House position is going to be a little bit different than the submission to the voters for the constitutional amendment. And I want to read that for the record because I think it's really important. So the proposed amendment must be submitted to the people of the 2026 state general election, and the question will be submitted as such. Quote, Shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to increase the funding going to all school districts from the Permanent School Fund, which is a fund that supports school districts without raising individual income or property taxes, effective July 1 of 2027? So the reason, and I actually worked on that with Representative Long, who had some experience working on constitutional amendments, so him and I worked together last week to bring that together because we wanted to make sure there wasn't confusion for the voters. So the House position, we're going to take a little different approach on that, and that's why this DEU is so important today, because we want to make sure that if we get this on the ballot, that the voters in Minnesota understand. But you heard it from the testimony we had here today. This, we are at such a unique opportunity with our Permanent School Trust Fund. If you look to the west of our country and look at other school trust funds that have been set up, many states didn't do the job that Minnesota did. You know, so instead of sitting on millions of acres of land, they sit on hundreds or thousands of acres of land, and they aren't able to fund education with it. Minnesota did it the right way, and now because we're sitting on this resource and we've generated a fund that's worth $2.3 billion, we can sit here in the year 2026 and look back at what our forefathers did and be like, it's time to change it because we can fund education even more. So the number that wasn't talked about today is that this constitutional amendment that sits in front of the committee today, if passed by the voters this November, will increase disbursements from the Permanent School Trust Fund by 40%. So to put that number into reality, this year, every pupil in the state of Minnesota got $68. In 2027, and the average could even increase based on how the markets do, but that'll increase it from $68 per pupil to $95 per pupil. We are seriously going to be able to fund education and help the kids of Minnesota without a single nickel being passed back to the taxpayers. And this is what, when our state crafted our Constitution with the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, this is what the end game was. So now we're in the year 2026, and you heard it from the School Trust Lands Director, you heard it from the State Board of Investment. That task force was a very broad and diverse group of people that brought with them the expertise from working in these fields, but also working with their communities and working in and around the industries that provide this sort of funding. The result is a really good constitutional amendment that is a bipartisan bill that we can move today that's going to give money to schools when they need it most. I really want to give a highlight to the language where it talks about management of the fund, because this is a really important part, and it was mentioned in the testimony. Having purchasing power being in our state constitution permanent to the Permanent School Trust Fund is so critically important, because one of the questions I was asked, and I appreciated the question from the representative, about making sure that we don't decline this fund. That is so critically important that we're going to be able to protect this fund for future generations. And also the foresight in the bill that we're going to do a 4.5% distribution, and that three-year rolling average is what's going to protect the fund. That way, even if markets had a really bad year, we're not going to hemorrhage the funding that exists in this account. We're always going to be growing, and we're always going to be looking out for that next generation of Minnesotans that are going to be in our schools. So I just can't thank the committee enough for a time. Looking forward to the little bit more testimony we have, but also if there's any questions, looking forward to having them. But this is a good move for the state of Minnesota for us to make this amend to our Constitution and to really start paying the money forward to our kids and funding public education.
Thank you, Representative Igo. And with that, we have two signed up testifiers. And so I have a representative from MSBA and then a student from Rosemont Apple Valley. Egan, if you would come up. And welcome. Please go ahead and state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kirk Schneider, and Executive Director for the Minnesota School Boards Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. First, thank you to Author Igo and the Permanent School Trust Fund Task Force for the serious bipartisan work behind this proposal. The recommendations are thoughtful, data-driven, and grounded in long-term fiduciary responsibility. The Permanent School Trust Fund is the student's trust fund. It was created to support public education in perpetuity, but the constitutional framework governing distributions limits our ability to modernize how earnings are calculated and distributed. Today, the fund distributes only what it earns in annual interest and dividends. In most years, that results in distributions below what a professionally managed endowment of this size could sustainably provide. In practical terms, we are managing a modern investment portfolio under an outdated formula. After extensive study, the task force recommends moving to a percentage of market value or POMV model. Under this approach, the state would distribute a fixed percentage, typically between 4 and 5%, based on a multi-year average of the fund's market value. That range reflects national best practice for large public endowments. It is designed to balance two responsibilities. You've talked about this, meeting current needs while preserving long-term purchasing power. A 4.5% rate calculated on a 3-year rolling average, as outlined in the bill, strikes the right balance. It would provide more stable and predictable funding for schools while protecting the integrity of the fund and future generations. Predictability matters. Right now, school districts across Minnesota are making difficult budget decisions. Boards are right-sizing programs, examining staffing levels, and delaying investments. In that environment, stable and reliable revenue is critical. School boards adopt annual budgets with an eye on the future, negotiate contracts, and make long-term commitments. Volatility makes that work harder. Stability strengthens governance. Moving the interest and dividends only model to a modern POMV framework is responsible endowment management. It aligns Minnesota with the national best practice and improves distribution reliability without raising taxes and creating ongoing spending. On behalf of MSBA, AMSD, MASA, as well as the Principals Association and the Minnesota Rural Education Association, we see state school districts from Greater Minnesota and our urban center strongly support House File 3900 and respectfully ask for your support.
And thank you for your testimony. And to the student, you only need to let us know your first name if you'd like. So please state your name, however much you want to use, and begin your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kierlin, and I'm a sixth grader in the Rosemount Apple Valley Egan School District. I'm here today because in fifth grade, I learned something pretty amazing. I am the beneficiary of a trust fund, and so is every student in a public school in the state. 2 years ago, I attended a hearing on school trust lands, and my grandma helped me understand the history behind it. What I learned is when Minnesota first became a state in 1858, land was set aside by our founding fathers so every student could learn to read, write, and do math. The money made from that land is called the Permanent School Fund, and it belongs to every student in Minnesota. Now, what I have learned is that the rules for how the money reaches our schools was written in the Minnesota Constitution a long time ago. Right now, schools can only receive the interest and dividends from the fund. In my school district, Rosemount Apple Valley Egan, our school received about $1.9 million from the Permanent School Fund last year. That funding supports things like technology and the wonderful teachers and staff who help us learn every day, and much more. If this amendment passes, the Rosemount Apple Valley Egan School District would receive about $2.7 million next year from the Permanent School Fund. That way, the way I see it, there is no downfall to passing this bill. Thank you for your time and for supporting students. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. And did you say it was Kierlin? Did I get that right? Kierlin. And Mr. Christensen, if you have any openings for a government relations intern, I would highly recommend Kierlin. Nice job. Members, with that, we are ready for testimony. Discussion, testimony. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any comments. Looking forward to supporting the bill, and I would request a roll call.
Representative Hudson requests a roll call. Roll call granted. Representative Bakeford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo, is Kira Lynn still in here? There you are. Fantastic job. Ms. Dietrich, you have found a successor. So Representative Igo, thank you, and to the other members of the commission, thank you for the work. Representative Igo, if you could just make sure that we all understand, are there any restrictions on these funds that school districts receive from the school trust lands?
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Bakeberg, thank you for the question. There is no encumbrance on these funds, and that's what makes them so absolutely critical across the state of Minnesota, because these funds come as a way for school districts to stop the gap. In my district, sometimes this is the difference between cutting a teacher or not. Other times it's making sure to fix the leaky gym. Other times it's making sure that the school buses can get upgraded so they can keep going out in the cold. But that's what's so important about these funds, is that they are the stopgap for a lot of things in our independent school district.
Representative Bakeberg, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Igo, for that. And I think this is the epitome of flexible funding. This is what school districts across the state have been asking for. And we need to do more of this, providing them with the funding, providing them with the flexibility, and then getting out of the way and allowing the local school board to make the determination on what is best for them. So thank you. Good bill. And I look forward to supporting it.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. This question is for the author. I wanted to go back to something that Director Lindy mentioned. I think earlier it was mentioned that 180,000 acres of this land trust is on tribal reservation lands, which to me, turns out to be about like 30% of the land in this land trust. And so just curious also if the author has done tribal consultation.
Representative Igo.
Thank you for the question. So, yes, so as we talk about the tribal lands, again, it's unique because the Office of the Permanent School Trust Fund, their job is to advise the different administrations and agencies that work in and around the school trust lands. So, really, the Department of Natural Resources is the one who manages these lands. There is ongoing conversations on the future of how we're going to move those lands out, if there's going to be land swaps. Those things have happened in the past of the Permanent School Trust Fund. But I think the biggest thing when you ask if there's been correspondence with our tribal nations, there was a tribal member appointed indeed to the task force that came up with this resolution that was voted on unanimously.
Representative Lee, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I understand if a government agency is reading statute and saying that maybe their council interpreted it as not requiring them to do consultation. I just think, for us working together in the legislature, like that's different, right? Because we're working to get at least 68 votes to pass a bill. And I think it's really important to engage all of our stakeholders in passing legislation. And so, I actually don't think that it's the fault of the agency for not doing the tribal consultation, right? Like each of us, when we're trying to pass legislation, wants to make sure that, we're dotting our I's and crossing our T's. And, again, if 30% of the land here is on, tribal land, then I think it's really important to engage those stakeholders. And if Mr. Lindy wants to comment, I think that that's fine. But also, right, like all of us are going to be voting on this legislation. So I think that's just really important.
Mr. Vandelay, did you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lee and Chair Joachim. I apologize. I had to go back and look at my notes from the task force to determine how much tribal consultation we actually did have during the task force. And we had specific meetings set up with tribal representatives during our task force meetings. So we did reach out as a task force to those tribal nations and did have those meetings. I just had to go back in my notes to see when they happened, to make sure that they did happen so that I could answer honestly. So I apologize for not being prepared earlier. As for the 30%, I think it's about 8% of the land is inside tribal reservations, not 30%. We are working with tribes to address that. I actually have a condemnation that's just getting started in Mille Lacs that's going to Representative Creasy, you probably know the parcel on Mille Lacs. We will be condemning that and transferring that. The department will be condemning that and transferring that to the Mille Lacs Band at no cost this year. That parcel has a long, sordid history. But a number of other projects that we have to address, but as I said, it's 180,000 acres. It's a big undertaking.
Representative Igo, did you have any following comments?
Yes, just wanted to follow up again to really highlight that there was a lot of collaboration that happened and really emphasize the tone, too, that it's not 30% mark. It's way smaller, and it requires a ton of work, not only from the Office of School Trust Lands, but also working with the DNR and tribal governments to work on land swaps. It's not just something we can just go ink. It requires title work, abstract work. It takes time. And the state of Minnesota and its agencies are working on amending this issue. We've been doing it since I entered the legislature and been serving on the Permanent School Trust Fund ever since. So we've had these proposals in front of our board, are actively working on it.
Thank you. Representative Lee,
follow-up, or are you good?
I think I'm good. I have another question for the State Board of Investment, but, I mean, if no one else wants to answer questions or ask questions, I mean, I'd like to ask that, but that's, yeah.
We have time. If you want to ask your question to the State Board, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Oh, and this can also go to the author, actually. I've been looking into this, and again, just again thinking about the recommendations, because it looks like, you know, this is maybe for lack of like a better metaphor, right? Like an agency bill that Representative Igoe is carrying, and so I know the investment board or the task force recommended the 3-year average. Just curious why that was chosen also, because I think in New Mexico, they also have a similar land trust, and they use a 5-year average. And so, yeah.
Representative Igoe.
So I actually can speak a little bit to this. So I just mentioned in my last response, I've served on the Permanent School Trust Fund Commission since I was elected. So I've been on, this is my now 6th year on the commission. Also, it was said in an earlier presentation, a lot of the school trust lands that are managed are in my district. So this is something that I've grown up around, lived around, and now served on now for 6 years. So that is my experience with the school trust lands. Yes, the task force brought with me these recommendations through state agencies, but it's something that's very adjacent to my job as a state representative for my district. So hence why I'm carrying the bill today. To your question about the 3-year rolling average, and I'll defer to either of the testifiers if they want to talk about more, but that average actually comes from a lot of other state funds that we do on rolling averages. For instance, a lot of production taxes for the mining industry are on 3-year averages because it makes a lot of fiscal sense for management in royalty funds. So that's why we mimicked it inside the legislation that we see here today. But if there's anything that either of the testifiers would like to add to it, that's a brief answer from my point of view to your question.
Mr. Blumenschein, did you have a comment to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to briefly add on to Representative Igoe's comments, the 3-year average was determined to be a bit more conservative in terms of protecting the long-term value of the fund, meaning that the distribution would decrease in value quicker during periods of market downturns than, say, a 5-year average. A 5-year average would keep a higher distribution amount for longer after a market downturn.
Thank you. And Representative Lee, unless you have a follow-up, I do have a couple other folks on the list.
Yeah. No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just kind of echoing what my colleague and former Representative Liz Leah stated in regards to the tribal contracts that don't receive, you know, a benefit from this, but we're on indigenous land, and you're saying that 8% out of the 30%, the numbers are kind of scattered. I would like to see the representation of, you know, maybe those tribal members that are part of this task force here in this presentation, let alone that there's 11 federally known tribes here in the state. And this is an impact. This is about how are we being progressive in initiating educational resources, land resources, but we're not, you know, one doesn't represent the entire tribal nations if we have 11. And so I understand that you represent this area, but I would hope that we can get some more input from that area that is being left out of the decision making. One person does not speak on behalf of 11 federal tribes, and that really is going to determine a very strong impact on the research that I have in making my decision, because as someone who has worked and been contracted by reservations on those federally funded schools, it's important that these conversations are outreached not just by one member of the tribe, but outreached on who are the youth who are in charge of talking about the impact of historical content when we discuss permanent school funding, what's permanent history in the decision making. And so I would request that, you know, MSBA look forward to getting more of those tribal recommendations of support, or what are the pits and what are the peaks when we're coming to discuss this HF 3900. That's fair enough. I don't have any questions, but just recommendations, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. And with that, members, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for members for having a thorough discussion. And I am a newbie on the board, and I look forward to learning a little bit more than I do know. And thank you for working on this. We had a late amendment coming today, but I know it was because you were working hard to make sure that the language of the amendment was actually something the average Minnesotan could understand compared to what it was before. But I do want to kind of echo what everybody else, what Representative Lee and Representative Perez Vega has set at this table. About a month ago, I started talking to you and Senator Kunesh and MSBA about the need to do that final consultation. I'm appreciative that you looked back in your notes to see if that had been done and that you did. But having that final bill in front of them is different to ask them their thoughts. And it's a government-to-government relations with 11 tribal nations, seven of which have these land trust properties on within their borders. So I would like a commitment from the authors. I know I have a commitment from our leadership on our side of the table to make sure those consultations happen before this leaves the Rules Committee. Mr. Chair, I believe that's where the motion is, to send it to Rules. So I would just like to hear your input on that, because I know in some folks' mind, which I kept being told by people, the constitutional amendment is separate than where these, what we do with the lands or where this lands is at. It's not. It's all of a package. We're making money off this land. Folks should be consulted with the end result before this moves forward. So with that, I mean, I know I signed on to the bill, but I signed on before I realized the work that hadn't quite been done. Our members are free to vote however they want, but I personally am just going to be a no vote just to make sure we get that final commitment. So I guess I would ask if you would be willing to have that final discussion with the different tribal nations before this gets out of Rules Committee.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Joachim. Yes, I'll follow up with following with all of our tribal nations on this bill. Get their take. Like I said, through the work, through the task force, talking to members of the task force, I do know there was that collaboration that happened there. But yes, since there's been a few changes to the bill, I'll make sure to follow that up for you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, so before I go to closing comments, you, Representative Michael, just a couple comments from me. So members, this bill, and Representative Igo, kudos to you for all the conversations and the outside groups and all the conversations that have happened to get to this point. I acknowledge and appreciate that, you know, we left time for it. I wanted lots of discussion on this. And I would just add that this has been a public process. It looks like it's been very transparent. I've read through the very thorough notes and all that. So any of those objections and all that, there's been plenty of opportunities for those comment periods as well. And I appreciate you taking the next step further, which is very authentic of you, to keep those conversations going. And so with that, members, I'll be supporting the bill. Representative Igo, your final comments before I call for a vote.
Well, again, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the first off, listening, but also for the questions today. I really appreciated it. It's kind of hard to have closing comments after I hear Lynn up here, because that was probably the best closing speech you could ever give right there. But again, I'll go back and do that work that Chair Joachim asked. I'll follow up with you on it as a bill author, but look forward to this bill moving forward. Again, it's very rare in state government that we get to have an opportunity in front of us to fund the kids of Minnesota without asking the taxpayers for a nickel. And that's what this proposal is in front of all of us. And we only have this in front of us because this state did it right when others didn't. So again, I appreciate the conversations today. Look forward to hopefully moving it again. But again, this is the way we're going to take care of the future generations of Minnesota without zero cost to the taxpayers. So thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Igo. And with that, members, there is a roll call requested. The legislative list is, members, the chair renews the motion that House File 3900, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Rules. There is a roll call that's requested. The Committee of Legislative Assistance will call the roll. Kreisha votes aye.
Chair Kreisha?
Aye.
Chair Joachim?
No.
Vice Chair Bakeberg?
Yes.
Vice Chair Clardy?
Aye.
Representative Altendorf?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Bennett?
Aye.
Representative DePell?
Aye.
Representative Engen?
Yes.
Representative Green?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Hill votes yes.
Representative Hudson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
No.
Was that no?
Lee votes no.
Thank you. Representative Knutson?
Yes.
Representative Lawrence?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Perez Vega?
No.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Ream.
Yes.
Representative Rabrower.
Aye.
Representative Reimer.
Aye.
Representative Sensor Mira.
Aye.
Representative Bernig.
Aye.
There being 21 ayes and 3 nays, the ayes have it, and House File 3900 as amended is re-referred to the Committee on Rules. Members, thank you for your discussion. That concludes, and I'll come to you, Chair Youakim, in a minute. That concludes our business for the day with the legislative break on Thursday. Chair Youakim, would you like to give us a preview? We have no committee hearing on Thursday. Members?